Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, a woman who already has a yellow card coming into today's podcast, Stafford Palmieri.
Hello. So what does that mean exactly, that I already have a yellow card?
Well, it's so confusing, right? Because what is it? If you have two yellow cards in the same game, you get a red card. Right? Mm-hmm. And then you're out, plus your team plays one man in the World Cup, one person short, trying to be gender neutral here. But there's a Women's World Cup, not this year. But then there's some confusion because there was some talk about how if people got another yellow card, they'd have to sit out the next game. And it is hard watching the World Cup. I mean, some of these calls, you know, you figure, okay, that didn't look like a foul at all. Okay, that looked like a little foul, or that looked like a big foul. And on any given day, that might get, you know, no call, a yellow card, a red card. Who knows?
I've seen some pretty violent stuff out there that has not gotten called.
Yeah,
just like grabbing each other, kicking each other in the heads when they go down.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah. So I hate to tell you this, Stafford, but really, you could get this second yellow card for almost any reason. Yeah. So I would just be tread very carefully. Yeah.
All right.
Lots to cover. We were away last week for the holiday, but the education policy world did not stop turning in our absence. So we will try to catch up here. So we'll play Pardon the Gadfly. We're going to hear Amber's Research Minute, and Janie will rate that reform. So, Mickey, let's get started with Pardon the Gadfly.
Okay. Last week, while we were away from the podcast, there was a lot of chatter, discussion, blogging, and whatnot about the so-called EduJobs provision of this new H.R. 4899. The basic idea of this is that $10 billion fund will be created to stave off teacher layoffs and will be paid for in part by taking $500 million out of Race to the Top and $300 million from other Department of Education reform initiatives. So I put a couple of questions up on the blog, and I was hoping we could kind of delve into some of these a little bit more deeper. So first of all, is this provision, assuming that the Senate does pass it, good for education?
Okay, so the assumption from reformers is that this is a huge blast at reform, that you've got Representative Obie on the Hill, who's a stalwart liberal who is retiring this year, who is very much allied with the teachers unions, that he's going after the administration and their reform priorities, which he is, let's be honest, and the unions are excited about this, no doubt. Still, I think that Mickey on the blog and Stafford, you hinted at this too, you know, I think there's a point to say that this is not the end of the world to take money away from Race to the Top. I mean, we've said on this show many, many times that there's too much money in that fund, that right now they are likely, if they have to give all the money away, give it to states that have mediocre applications and haven't done much reform. So don't just take $500 million, take $1 billion from my perspective. That's fine, because in the end that'll help us focus Race to the Top on states that are truly worthy. Mm. I feel a little different about the charter school money and the merit pay money that they're also going after. What do you think, Stafford?
I think you're right. I think we can be more selective by doing that. But at the same time, had Race to the Top not been so big, would it have encouraged state legislatures to be as active as they've been?
Well, who cares? I mean, they acted under a certain set of, you know, assumptions. Well, and I know it's maybe not fair to change the rules in the middle of the game, but hey, what's done is done. I mean, we've already gone out of Race to the Top. What we're going to get out of it?
Well, I asked Rick about this very question when I was putting together my blog while he was away traveling and somewhere in beautiful in Europe. And he said that he was opposed to the current measure, more or less because of the fairness idea that states have played by the rules. They listened to their feedback after round one. They made their changes with the assumption that there was going to be, you know, a pretty good chance that they were going to get something out of it.
Yep.
And that if that money is suddenly pulled out from under the rug, that they're going to feel frustrated and angered and skeptical about the federal role in general.
Well, they should feel skeptical about the federal role. I mean, boo-hoo-hoo. I mean, what do you think, Stafford?
I definitely see the silver lining here about the being more selective. But at the same time, I guess my take on Race to the Top, I've been skeptical about Race to the Top. It hasn't been as successful as we thought it would be, blah, 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 blah. But at the same time, maybe the most depressing thing here is that if Race to the Top was our least worst option of how to spend federal dollars, and now it's gotten a whole lot rosier. You know, once OB goes after it, now we're, the reform community has definitely sort of stepped up and said this is an outrage and Race to the Top is the best, you know, thing that we've seen in education spending so far.
But let's also say this. I mean, our lefty friends, particularly those closely allied with the Democratic Party, have put themselves into a corner, all right, because they did not come right out and say to Representative Obie and to the NEA and others that, hey, no, there should not be another bailout of local school districts. No, this is not, the federal government's not responsible every time you've got a budget shortfall. You've got to find a way to live within your means. I mean, let's be honest, there's been a huge increase in spending at the state and local level. It was a bubble like these other bubbles that have burst. It was based on rising home prices and rising tax bases. Now that bubble has burst, and they've got to learn to live within their means. And so, you know, to just perpetuate this and say, no, the federal government or is going to borrow more money from China to bail you out again. I mean, they put themselves in this corner where now Randy Weingarten can say, hey,
yeah, absolutely.
You know, if you think that this bailout is legitimate, then you should, you know, your pet program should take a haircut too.
Yeah.
And I think she's got a legitimate point. If we agree with the basic premise that the federal government should be doing this in the first place. Topic.
Okay. Online bullying is becoming a major headache at schools, not least of all because it removes the basic barrier between in-school and out-of-school behavior. What can be done to combat this growing problem?
I guess I'd start with the premise that we've never assumed that kids have full privacy or full right to free speech in schools. I guess schools are kind of they're in loco parentis, I guess the expression is. And so I think that schools have a role here to play in terms of mediating online bullying, especially as it interferes with school. And that's really sort of been the lesson, is that it does interfere with school, especially in middle school when kids are using these online platforms to avoid face-to-face confrontation. And it just like escalates, and then the school has to spend 10, 12 hours dealing with this, which is a lot of time. But at the same time, you know, these TIFFs are coming to school with these kids, even if they happen outside of school. And so the school has to do something about it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple issues here. I mean, one is the legal issue, and the law on this is totally messed up because we have such a confused idea about students' rights to free speech. I mean, look, I mean, this might sound kind of, you know, crazy right wing, but I think we should go back to the whole Tinker decision back in the 60s.
Yeah.
You know, that decision said, oh, well, you know, kids don't give up their free speech rights by walking through the schoolhouse door. I don't know. Maybe they should. I mean, they're minors. They're, you know, we're talking about kids.
But the Tinker decision also said that schools can interfere. Schools can discipline as far as it interferes with school.
And there's been a lot of case law since then, and it's somewhat confusing. It goes back to the Bong Hits for Jesus case, and I mean, the court's trying to figure out these fine lines about when schools can actually step in and regulate free speech. A separate question, though, is just on the merits. Forget what the law says. I mean, what's the right response for a school here? I mean, I suspect that if you look at well-run private schools, where we're not in the same situation of public entities and stuff,
right.
You know, they talk about there being a school community, and that community includes the teachers and the parents and the kids, and they're all part of this community. And so they would find a way to address this kind of issue as a community. I feel for public schools. They may feel like legally they don't have the same ability to do that, but that's what you really need. I mean, you need this sort of effort to kind of bring all the parties together and say, hey, this is, you know, we're not going to accept this kind of behavior in our community that goes against our rules, you know, just as any other real community would set its rules for itself.
Yeah, it's definitely looking at liability versus perpetuating, you know, the school community. Absolutely.
All right, that's all the time we've got for Pardon the Gadfly, but we've got plenty of time for Amber's Research Minute. All right, what are we chatting about today?
All right, we are chatting about the highly anticipated final evaluation of the DC voucher program. It has arrived. As you may well recall, it's a gold standard evaluation that randomly assigned roughly 2,300 students to receive or not receive an offer of a voucher. Prior evaluations found that vouchers positively impacted the reading scores among certain subgroups, such as those coming from better schools, but those differences were not quote-unquote robust. So this last evaluation finds that overall, reading and math scores were not significantly impacted by the program after at least 4 years was the phrasing. So in other words, some of the students were actually in the program longer. And this held true for students in different subgroups, including the students who applied from the worst schools. The better news, the program positively impacted graduation rates. The offer of a voucher raised the probability of a student graduating by 12 percentage points overall, meaning the graduation rate for the treatment group was about 82%, the control group it was around 70%, and it slightly improved for those children who were applying from the worst schools. I know this is kind of a lot. Finally, using the scholarship, okay, because that was the data I was just giving you were those who had the offer. Using the scholarship increased the rate by 21 percentage points. So all in all, these are not terrible findings for such a rigorous evaluation, which was recently, as we all know, the program killed off by Congress.
So now I read something by Paul Peterson where he was trying to make a case that that even at in terms of test scores, it certainly looked like the voucher kids were outscoring the other kids, but there was some controversy about whether it met the significance test.
So it was about 4 points different. So in other words, the voucher kids scored about 4 points higher in the reading test, which is really noteworthy because when you dig into the tables, I don't know, the significance cutoff is 0.05. So when you look at that one cell in that data table, it's actually 0.06, which means it barely missed the mark for being statistically significant. And if you're a Pat Wolf, you pay attention to those things, as you should in a gold standard study. So the bottom line is, it barely missed the cutoff for being significant. So that's why he had to word it like he did.
As I recall, this is the four-year impact.
Right.
So the third year version of this did find positive achievement
impacts.
For the
subgroups.
Right?
For the reading, for the subgroups.
So what changed?
They weren't robust. So in other words, they were kind of tentative. When you do this other analysis that compares for multiple comparisons, which is this upper echelon type of thing that you have to do when you do these gold standard studies, those differences tended to go away. And we didn't used to do those really rigorous tests, and now we do, and they tend to disappear. So, I mean, this is just really, but still, and I always say this, when you have an evaluation this rigorous to find anything is a big deal.
And, these results on graduation rates are
yes,
huge.
That's exactly right.
Big
well, I didn't mean to dig the graduation rates, but it was just that the third year impact study was used as sort of, how can we get rid of this program that has positive effects on achievement?
Right. So. And we also, know that some of the kids in the treatment, in the control group, they didn't necessarily just stand still. Many of them may have gone into public schools. They might have found a way to get into private schools on their own.
Right.
So it's complicated. It's not quite comparing, again, public to private.
Yeah, that's right.
Amber, another big question I want to know. Is it true that you've been on Fox and Friends twice in the last week?
Twice.
Whoa. Because you decide to go to the beach.
Well, I did. And I've got sand on my shoes still, just to prove it. Yes, too bad it's not a video podcast. Amber, what is going on? What were you talking
exciting.
About?
It was exciting. I was talking about having multiple valedictorians. You know how we have these schools? I don't think we've talked about it. 40, 60... 80 valedictorians at schools.
Yeah,
you know,
I understand this might be the subject of our Rate That Reform.
Equity. Oh, sorry, I won't steal Janie's thunder, but that was what I was talking about.
Wow,
so.
Boom.
It was
boom.
Crazy.
We don't want to damage the psyche of our children.
And they got so many emails. I guess people were really interested in this because they, obviously most people can relate to having, they remember their valedictorian and that was a big deal and now we're kind of watering it down.
So what was your, how'd you come out?
So my shtick was that it was ridiculous and we need to care more about rewarding merit and true academic excellence than equity and hurting kids' feelings.
Nice.
That was what it was.
Well, Amber.
That's why we've eradicated the red pen. It is damaging to our children.
All right.
Must create in blue or black.
So, Amber, what are we going to, what's the song we're going to sing?
So,
today?
Since this program created a lot of controversy and fighting, we have Kung Fu Fighting by Carl Douglas.
Great.
Remember
song.
The song?
Nice.
Fighting. Those kids were fast as lightning.
That was a different version than I remember. It must have been a remake that came along later.
I think it was by the Village People. The original.
The original?
Am I totally wrong? I may be wrong.
But we probably didn't have rights to that one. So this is, we do what we can here on the show. Okay, Janie, well, Amber already let the cat out of the bag here, huh? We're going to talk about Valak.
I feel like it's going to be such a letdown now.
Well, you know
everyone
what?
Knows.
But see, here on the show,
delivery, in my
here
opinion.
On the show, since we are a substantive show, unlike something like Fox and Friends, we're going to give you more time. I mean, Amber probably had time to give about 8 seconds worth of comments. And
we don't invite Palin to be a contributor on our podcast.
That's right. So, Janie, we'll give you at least 16 seconds.
Okay.
All right. So what's the deal?
So yeah, high schools across the country, they're naming more than one valedictorian. Some have named, as Amber mentioned, as many as 30, about 7% of the entire graduating class. School leaders say that, where in a world where final student GPAs are separated by only, hundredths of a point, it's not really fair to raise one student above the other and say this one's clearly superior. And they also say, you know, by naming a bunch of valedictorians, you reduce competition and keep students focused on what's actually important. Critics, of course, argue that this kind of devalues the title itself. And the dean of admissions at Harvard, actually, who, you know, I would presume receives more applications from valedictorians than anyone else, says that, yeah, the title has basically been rendered meaningless. So as Amber mentioned, you know, the sentiment behind it is, of course, well-intentioned. You know, the high-stakes college application process has students scrambling to kind of amass awards and extracurriculars and honors classes and all that stuff. And, you know, as Mickey, I'm sure, would argue, grades are kind of meaningless and, you know, a hundredth percentage point really doesn't mean anything. But at the same time, you know, that's the whole point of the title. We're looking for the best. And if, you know, if our metrics are not perfect, our metrics aren't perfect. But there's no point in taking a title that means the best and giving it to 30 people. So, you know, there should be another way that we can diffuse things mm-hmm. by naming people as honor students or recognizing achievement. But valedictorian title should stay one person. So I gave the reform a C.
Nice. Mm. Okay, so I think that there are some obvious solutions here. All right, so you've got a school with 30 kids that are all within hundreds of points from one another.
And a lot of them all have A's or all have above 4.0s, yes, which is possible.
Understood. At that point, I think you arrange some sort of tournament where you have them battle it out, a battle of the wits. You know, you could have like a Jeopardy-style thing. There's all kinds of things.
See, I think that devalues it as well, because that in itself is kind of meaningless. You know, when you take into account 4 years of work and an average of 4 years of work.
You could make it meaningful.
That's a lot more important,
though. You could have an essay contest. You could have, I mean, there's definitely ways you could narrow it down and come up to one person. And by the way, I think this competition, I mean, I understand it can stress out a lot of kids, and I feel for that. On the other hand, it's one of the few things that keeps kids working hard to the end of their senior year.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's true. The issue that this raises for me is actually differences in school quality, because a lot about being a valedictorian is that you're better than everyone else in your class, but if you go to a crappy school, what does that actually mean?
Yeah, but you have to keep that in mind, obviously. I mean, you wouldn't
right,
say that
but
to the
we
kid,
don't really have, but I mean, but I guess schools like you know, Yale and Harvard, they look at whether you're a big fish in a big pond or a big fish in a little pond, and then they also look at sort of your objective GPA. But how do those two things balance out? I guess, I don't know, this just makes me think, like, if I had gone to an incredibly, incredibly rigorous high school, would I have gotten into the college that I got into? Questions.
All right. Well, we don't have time for Stafford's therapy here today, but that's okay. It's been a great show. We'll see you again next week. Until then,
I'm Stafford Palmieri.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Education Gadfly Show, always available at edexcellence.net. We will also find the Education Gadfly newsletter. I'm signing off.